just a way, as a way of introduction to this, you have to be able to get all of the exhibits you're going to see and all the talks in some sort of perspective. And among the hobbies I have is collecting antique radios and books that go with them. Now, I came across a book that was published in 1927, just about 50 years ago. And it was, in fact, a beginner's guide to getting involved in radio. And there were people getting involved in radio that were winding their own parts. There were all sorts of cautions written, such as were referred to in some of the earlier talks and some of the cautions that you get now with kits and other parts. And it's an amazingly interesting repeat of an explosion in technology is this entire gist of microprocessors. And it's befuddling for the beginner, for sure, to pinpoint how is he going to evolve into it. Is he going to be a man who's going to work with hardware and try to build some devices himself, or is he not concerned? Is he going to buy just a black box and sit down at his terminal and that's all he cares about? The field is certainly wide enough to accommodate everyone. As an opinion, I'd say you'll get more out of your devices if you develop some understanding of what's going on the inside. Not necessarily it has to be. There are people who enjoy their hi-fi systems beautifully without being one bit concerned with any of the electronics contained within. Nonetheless, the emphasis that I have and I've found effective with people is to try to suggest that they get somewhat involved with the internal workings. Now, the title of the talk, Side Lobes of Industrial Distribution, is really related to what is distribution, and it's worth saying just about a few words. The distributor is a middleman between the manufacturer of semiconductor parts and resistors and capacitors. He stocks parts and sells them to manufacturers of equipment, and the expression is he sells to OEMs, which are original equipment manufacturers. He in turn may in fact sell back to the semiconductor manufacturers such as the Intels and the Nationals. Largely, he's been out of the mainstream of the everyday user, and it isn't ordinary that distributors would be involved in even a personal computing show. But again, as with other things, this exploding field is having really an effect on the distributor. If the people that are out there using his products aren't familiar with them, he's not going to be able to sell them. So at the same time that the distributor is working with his conventional customers, he's plowing new trails towards the home hobbyists and users. And the hobbyist is often a mixed breed. He may be working during the day in some industrial environment. He may be at a college. As a matter of fact, I talk to many people that are working on at least two levels. Nominally, they're coming in because their company is interested. Actually, they're coming in because they're interested themselves. So the hard and fast line between manufacturers and home users is kind of evaporating. Couple this with the fact that microcomputers lend themselves to home laboratories where you can set up a small workstation yourself in your garage and go from there, and what you really need is aid and assistance to get started. To get back to this first slide, the main lobe, and that's an antenna radiation pattern, of a distributor is naturally and mostly focused directly on the industrial user. But there's enough spillover energy there in those little side lobes to aim itself directly at the hobbyist, and that's the group I'm aiming for right now. Now on the next foil, we see a typical picture of what a distributor's operation looks like. It's a little old shack, and not all the parts turn up, but in the upper right-hand corner is his microprocessor center. Inside there is his sales force sitting around the table, and it's sort of a parody takeoff on what distributors are trying to do. On the next one, we get into more factual information as to what the distributor is doing. The column on the left is his standard category of parts. Conventionally, for the last 15 years, he's been selling all those good products. But now he's moving into a total new area. He sets up an electronics and computer store to make available to the hobbyist and the moonlighter all those products listed on the left. He started a microprocessor development center, which has some of the equipment that I'll be describing. It's essentially, it's a facility within his building which has for demonstration, for hands-on use, the processor systems that are made by his franchised houses, such as his Intels, Nationals, Texas Instruments, etc. For those of you that have been working with the processors, you may be familiar with the PROMs and the field programmable PROMs. I know they were touched on in one of the earlier talks this morning. What has really helped this processor get started for people is the fact that they can easily get their programs put into semiconductor memory. And it's not merely a problem of taking their programs and sending them off to the factory. They can do it themselves. Either they can buy their own small PROM programmers for perhaps as low as $800 and program their PROMs, or they can use the facility that the distributor has set up, and the charges for PROM programming are typically between $2.50 and $3.50 a piece. You can take your program in via the store or whatever other mechanism you use and get your PROM program, perhaps get your old one erased and reused. So it's providing a very definite service. And the assembly operation is probably less well known. You know these various processor things use flat ribbon cables, they use special switches. These are all items that were not previously available to the hobbyist, they really were available to the industrial user. But now the hobbyist who's configuring his own system can come in and say, I want a 20 conductor flat ribbon cable so-and-so, and maybe you can tell me, he says this to the salesman, what'll go on to my Motorola kit. And lo and behold, he can, while he waits, in fact, have this cable made up and walk out with his cable and his switches. These are the kind of nuts and bolts of the processor building that are not typically available, and it's well worth it to the hobbyist to know that he can go down and try to get that. Now, my field of operation is up in Seattle. So I can be reasonably objective in talking to the group here. I'm not specifically trying to drum up any business. Not all distributors here are doing the same thing, but I think you can find which distributors in your own markets are providing these services and which ones aren't, and so talk to them and let them know that this is something you need and want, etc. It's a very feasible thing and it makes good sense for the distributor as well. Next slide, please. The heart of processors and the processor center is the development system. Now, we'll talk just a bit about what is a development system. It also includes the IMSIs, the Altairs. It's the piece of test equipment that has evolved to service the use of processors. Obviously, they're very complex devices. They respond to ones and zeros. You write in one language, the machine runs in another language. You can kludge up some piece of equipment to work with your processor, but what has been evolving in the last 3 or 4 years is that the semiconductor manufacturers initially, and probably Intel was the first, developed a console which contained in that center box there RAM memory, as I say, 16K up to 64K with generally expandability. That means they have 16-bit address buses. They have ROM memory and system monitors. They have I/O interfaces to the outside world. They are, in fact, full microcomputers. Now, with that block, as I say, it could correspond to whether it's a hobbyist system or an industrial system, but it's the major console. Originally, they were developed for software editing and debugging. They came in order to allow a user to have a resident assembler and editor and documentation to take his program from his mnemonics into the machine language. And probably Intel was the first, as nearly as I can tell. They were software consoles, and they represented the alternate to using a timeshare terminal. You remember a few years ago, people were doing their assembling and editing on GE timeshare, for instance. Now with a console, they had the ability to do this in a laboratory. They further have evolved now to allow you to do a hardware checkout by the development of some of the new peripherals that will plug into a development system. They'll allow you to run a cable from that major chassis over to your piece of equipment on the bench, whether it's a kit or any piece of hardware. And essentially, the console takes over operation of your system in real time and allows it to execute the program, sets breakpoints in the program, so that you can actually hardware debug your system as well as software debug. They have, now we'll get to the little blocks around it. Obviously, to make this system console work, you need means of entering data. The original means of entering data was via teletype, and people rushed out and bought up surplus teletypes as fast as they could find them until they became extinct. The teletype provided the ideal mechanism. People worked in paper tape, and they were able to both get a record of their program, a hard copy record, as well as a punch paper tape. That was followed in turn by the CRT terminal. We gave up the hard copy, but it was a lot faster, a lot quieter, and much easier really to use, but you still don't have the same ability. That CRT terminal then it can be augmented with a line printer in order to have high-speed copy. Then, because the teletype was so slow and tended to introduce some errors, people were willing to manually input their data on teletype, but their paper tapes, they wanted a high-speed paper tape reader. And so the minimal systems often would be a console, a teletype, and a paper tape reader for loading in the software that came with your development system. It has now evolved where you have gone by the paper and we're in floppy disk systems. So that becomes a portion that plugs into the console. Typically, people use dual drive disks so they can make copies of their programs, and that the dual drive disk is probably the most reasonable, fast unit to use. As an additional add-on to these major consoles is the PROM programmer. Again, this is more for a volume user, but at an additional cost, someone would plug in a PROM programmer into the major console and be able to do the family of PROMs associated with the manufacturer of the particular console. That is something of a drawback if you want to mix and match PROMs to systems. Finally, we have this in-circuit emulator, which I referred to in words before. It's your hardware checkout device. Now, as I say, all of the systems you'll see on the floor here, from wherever they come, roughly follow that block diagram. If you're using a system purely for playing games, then this is an overkill. You don't need the hardware checkout device, the emulator. You don't need the PROM programmer, etc. If you're using your equipment to develop some product, whether it's to develop your automatic sprinkler or name it, then this hardware emulator becomes a very desirable feature. Let me hit you with some of the prices for this. Typically, the development systems from the semiconductor manufacturers run higher than the hobbyist systems. They're generally made of perhaps faster RAMs. They generally have more monitor and more documentation. In turn, they tend to cost more, perhaps another 20%. So that I'm not for a moment suggesting that the home hobbyist necessarily is going to run out and buy these. A basic console from the semiconductor houses typically runs about $4,000, and you get 16K of memory with it, and the I/O interfaces, and some ROM program might be 256 bytes or 512 bytes. Now, those have fairly universal interfaces, so you needn't go back and buy his CRT, but can go off and buy the Beehive or the Layer Sigler and so on. The emulators are roughly about $1,000, and as I say, are well worth that value if you're doing a hardware checkout. PROM programmer is about $1,000. Disk systems run in the vicinity of $3,000 for a dual drive, $3,000, $3,300. So you're talking in that kind of a ballpark, and as I say, for the average home hobbyist, it may be expensive, you know, but it's important to know what's available and then you make your trade-offs. We'll come back to some of these, discussion of some of this. Always one other item with the little circles around it is the software. The manufacturers are also making available the variety of software to run this, and originally it was software for editing and assembly. The trend now is to have resident software for high-level languages. And that then becomes arguments in favor of the hobbyist. You can have BASIC running on the national system, BASIC on the Motorola. Intel has PLM. The important thing, and Motorola has Fortran. The important thing is that they're resident in the system. And so now you can have your high-level language running on one of these resident consoles. Next slide, please. Now, if you haven't seen these, this is just showing pictures of some of the system. The one in the upper left-hand corner is the console of the Motorola system, their exerciser, and behind it is the dual drive disc, and on top of it is the high-speed paper tape reader, plus the literature, et cetera, to the right. In the middle, the Intel, that's the Intel MDS-800 console, shown hooked in using an ICE, or one of these in-circuit emulators that I mentioned, for a hardware checkout of a piece of equipment that's being built separately away from the equipment. And I won't go into a heck of a lot of detail on it, but often the justification of a system is the ability to use the emulator. What it does is it'll use the memory within your system, but if you don't have enough memory, it essentially will borrow memory from the MDS, and it'll borrow I/O ports. Now, when it's in the borrowing mode, it's not a real-time simulation. So you use it in whatever manner makes most sense to you, but you could put all the memory and all the I/O ports on your system, say if you were using one of the single-board computers, for instance, and then, in fact, it would be a real-time running of the system. On the lower right is the national system, either for the IMP, and it looks very much like national system for the PACE. As an interesting sidelight, when the equipment first started coming out, they all had switches on the front panel for manually loading their data. And they also had rotary keys to let you look at what's going on in each of the registers, in the program counter, in the stack pointer. They really gave you a very, very expanded view. Then they found, as a cost-cutting device, they would take all this off the front panel and let you do it via software. You always could have done it via your teletype and go in and ask to see it. But it's delightful, I feel at least, to have the option both to get it as a printout and...
I'm the next session chairman. I'm going to give you 3 minutes. It's 1 o'clock.
Oh, this is how we started late. Talk to my chairman.
Where is he?
He's walking around here.
But we just started about 3 minutes ago.
You did?
Yeah. Oh, there's my chairman over there. Small interruption. Okay. So the ideal thing would be able to have both the manual input via switches as well as to have printouts. Since many have moved away from that, you can get that with the national system, but with the Intel system, you largely have only buttons enough there for your various interrupts that you want to activate, and the rest of the investigation of what's going on in registers and memory locations is done via your terminal, CRT or teletype. If I could have the next fellow, please. Now, this is a listing of what a center is. Now, this is a generic center. Not every center is going to work this way. You should be able to get some of this either at your local bike shop or at your local distributor, but you should find someone who can give you this kind of information. If you're going to make an investment of anything from $4,000 to $10,000, you certainly want to be able to do these things. You want to be able to go in and talk to someone and find out what's available, and that's the technical information bit. You want to have some hands-on experience if you haven't been exposed to this before, and you want to try out typically more than one system and understand their properties. You might, depending how serious you are in it, want to benchmark your programs, which is essentially develop your program for more than one system. Maybe the Motorola language is ideal, and maybe it's the Intel language, which is the one that you want to use with your equipment. And you want to be able to benchmark it, and maybe time in running your program is very important. You can, in many operations, come in and use this equipment on a daily fee basis if you plan to use it for, say, 10 days or so, and you may want to assemble and edit your program. You can have your problems programmed via the equipment, and you can check out a prototype type system. So that's what the center is there to function as. If we move on to the next one, this will give you a typical idea of what kind of equipment is found in a center. And it really, of course, hinges on what lines that particular distributor is carrying. Now, I know you have a center down here at Elmar, for instance, which is fairly well equipped, for example, and you'll find some of this equipment there. First is what we have, and is a typical breakdown, is the Intel system, the basic one, which plus the add-on features that I spoke about earlier. from prom programmers to simulators to printers. In National, there is a PACE system, 12K, which PACE's claim to fame is excellent numerical computation and number crunching type thing, and it's a 16-bit system. And again, you'll notice the typical items, the programmer, the printers, and the teletypes. Motorola has a complete system in their exerciser with their Exadisc and the software that is associated with it. And finally, you come to Texas Instruments, who has come out recently with their system for the 9900 16-bit processor, and they too have evolved with a new development system, which includes a CRT high-speed paper tape reader in the entire bit, and the software. Now, what's interesting about TI is that their software for their microcomputers is compatible with the software for their mini computers, which for some people is a very important factor, so they can move freely through the TI family using software and routines developed on their MSI medium scale circuitry and on their LSI 9900 system. So this gives you a breakdown of kind of things within a processor center. Next, please. And as I was saying, what kind of things can you have done in an assembly area? You can have the different ribbon cable assemblies. Connectors, Molex connectors are used on the teletypes very freely. Elko connectors are for the printed circuit board, card edge connectors, and so on down the line. And in PROM programming, you should find some PROM programming equipment available to be used. Next, please. Now, as I keep saying, it's such an expanding market, it might help to get a perspective of what's going on is to look at the size of the market for microprocessors in 1976 as it's broken down among the 4-bit, 8-bit, and 16-bit markets. You see, you're talking about a market there that's about $33 million in 76, where the 16-bitters are only getting about 18% of it. And a lot of interest, of course, is in the 8-bit one, whether it's the 8080 or the 6800. The 4-bit is the 4040 and the 4004, and interest is kind of fading a bit on those. National SCAMP falls into the category of the low cost, and those have about 41% of the market. Now, if you see the projections to 1980, it at least gives you a clue, perhaps, on what chips and what you want to work with as time goes on. The 16-bit market will grow considerably, and the 8-bit market will have just a smaller percentage. Of course, the entire dollar volume is obvious is going to get over 80, so you're going to have something like a tripling of the market for processors. But you can see that the 8-bit is going to get somewhat less, and the 16 a good deal more, and as percentages, the low cost is going to dwindle a bit. Next one, please. Now, it may be of some interest to people that are building and making choices that what they're going to spend on their chips is going to be such an insignificant, small part. Around when processors started, the CPU, the 8080 and the IMP16, et cetera, accounted for about 25% of the cost of someone's system. You can see as they project out to 1980, it's only going to account for something like 10% of the cost. It's the peripherals, the I.O. chips, that are going to be taking up the largest bulk of the market, and of course memory, and is the reason why everyone is so concerned with the price of memory coming down. The trick is not to get all excited because an 8080 comes down a few dollars, but to just watch and see what happens with the memory, the 16K PROM, will that start coming down, and what about the 64K RAM, etc. All your dollars are really going to be going into memory. And that's going to be true whether you're buying boards fully made by Altair or IMSI or anyone else. Your dollars will be going into memory. Next, please. Now let's see what some of these products are that you're going to be working with. And I'm particularly emphasizing the products that are aimed towards the lower cost or what I conceive to be more of a hobbyist type market. TI brought out their 9900 that was not a hobbyist processor, it's a 16-bit unit, but what they're doing now is bringing out the 9980, which is an 8-bit version.
Yeah. Are you two again? We're negotiating
I'm afraid that we'll have to try
it's
for.
It's 5 after 1 already.
Yeah, somebody else is trying. They're trying for another room.
Okay.
So maybe they'll
okay.
do that. But it's 5 after 1. The next session is supposed to start.
Yeah, I know, but the whole thing got delayed.
Understand.
I think you're going to have to start yours late. I don't want to get into that kind of a hassle.
Okay, well, you've got 5 minutes, okay?
No.
No? No
then
more slides.
Well, let's get another room for the other session.
Okay, how many are here for the electronic mail session?
Yay!
How many are here for the present session?
Okay, I'll move through these rapidly, especially since my, well, you can see I'm kind of torn between the people who want to hear the session. Okay, the session is closed.
Okay, this is, shall we say, somewhat confused. I understand that the old session has a new room. You want to tell me about the new room?
We do have a room where we can continue the session that was just on, that Dr. Smilin was on. And could we see a show of hands how many would like to have this continued? Or because we can move the equipment and go up to room 303. How many would be interested in doing that? Well, I guess we'll have to continue on a personal basis then. If any of you do want to have any questions for him or want to review the material in more detail, he'll be available. And if you have any other questions from that session, I'll be available. Otherwise, the floor is yours.
Okay, in case you haven't. I have no idea. I recommend you to a program. Now, this is Larkin 103. This is the electronic mail session. Is there anybody else equally confused? This is the electronic mail session. Would you believe I don't know how to do that? Yes. Does anybody in the corner of the room see if he can find a light switch? I believe so. Yeah, there's a map in your.
Yeah, but it just says what I
zero. Well, my apologies, I don't know what to do.
See, this is just 103, I suppose, and there's an A somewhere.
Well, this is the electronic mail session, and that's all that I really know about. Okay, this is now the electronic mail session.
Yay!
And can you hear me now? Can everyone hear me? Okay. Pardon? Better? Everybody hears me loud and clear? Good. My name is Dave Calkins. I am the chairperson of the electronic mail session. As our first speaker, we have John McCarthy, and I think we are very fortunate. He is one of the really eminent people in the computer science game. He is going to tell us about DialNet. John?
I think I'll start with a little background and mention, because DialNet is in some respects a descendant of the ARPANET, I would like to give a little description of that. This is a project that was started in the late 60s by Larry Roberts, who was then, or on the initiative of Larry Roberts, who was then the head of information processing techniques for ARPA, which is Advanced Research Projects Agency of the Defense Department. And the idea of ARPANET was that the Defense Department would rent suitable communication facilities from the telephone company and would use this to connect a number of research projects that they were supporting, the computers of these research projects, and also to connect it with various Defense Department installations. The way this was realized is by putting at each site a small computer called an IMP, or Interface Message Processor, and that had suitable programs in it and was connected to each of the so-called host computers. In addition to the host computers, there are also small computers called TIPs, terminal interface processors, which can be connected to terminals only, either mainly by telephone. The ARPA networks operates by message switching, that is, a message at one of its nodes is transmitted to a closer node that is closer topologically to the recipient node, and these messages are passed on from node to node until they arrive at the recipient node. I would like to mention, go on now from, this is as much as I wish to say about the technology of the ARPANET.